Hello, folks.
Yeah, Bazers is doing the show with us.
Yeah, she decided Beijing. She was going to come settle in my lap while we were recording.
Yeah,
spoiled. well, yeah.
She's spoiled.
Yeah, she is very spoiled.
Yeah.
So maybe you'll be able to hear her purring. I'm not really sure. Yeah. But so on this installment of the movie retrospective, we are finally getting around to one of my very favorite movies of the 1980s, one of my very favorite horror comedies, that is for goddamn sure, and I can't believe it's taken us this long to get to it. This is 1985's Fright Night.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this movie in a long time.
Oh, I fucking love this movie.
It was a lot
so
better.
Much.
It was a lot better than I remembered it. It's a lot better than I remembered it, and it had a lot of character development in the characters. The themes were a lot deeper than I remember. The writing was good, man. Writing was good from this era.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the cool thing about this one, now, this was the directorial debut of Tom Holland. He would go on to do Child's Play and many other things. Prior to this, he had been an actor, and then he had been a screenwriter. Matter of fact, he wrote the screenplay for Psycho 2, which was actually way fucking better than it had any right to be. He also had written the screenplay for Class of 1984. Now, when he was getting into doing this, and the one thing, one of the best things about this movie, among its many amazing qualities, what?
Yeah, she's
is that you can tell that everyone involved, particularly Tom Holland, was like super, super into this project because there's such an affection for the genre, like, on display, like, and from everyone involved, that they really, really wanted to make this the best possible movie that they could make it. And it really, really kind of, like, shines through in, like, how sweet and fun, like, an homage this is. Because the thing about Fright Night is that, so Tom Holland got the idea. He's like, I was just thinking about, you know, just a thing about a high school kid or a college kid whose neighbor is a vampire and nobody believes him. And he's like, and I thought that would make a really funny premise for a movie. Now, it should be noted that when this came out in 1985, I mean, horror movies, I mean, slashers were like a big thing. And so they even kind of comment on that, like, inside Fright Night, where there's sort of, oh, teenagers don't want to see vampires anymore. You know, they want to see teenagers getting, you know, or what do you say, like, hacking up young virgins or something like that. Someone in a ski mask hacking up young virgins. So the interesting thing about this, though, is that, so it's kind of like a meta, you know, just kind of a meta thing, like, on the genre as a whole, the vampire genre, like that old school, like, Hammer horror type of thing, like horror hosts and stuff, which in 1985 was kind of pretty much going out of fashion.
Yeah, it was kind of a throwback for its day.
Yeah, but it's like, so it was kind of like a love letter to that.
Yeah.
But interestingly, when it came out and did so well and got like a lot of critical praise and it like made a lot more money than they were expecting, it actually kind of kickstarted, like it almost made vampires cool again. You know what I mean? Because like, you know, then Near Dark came out, Lost Boys came out, and it's almost like it reinvigorated the vampire genre, like, for a new generation, I guess. Because at that point, like I said, Hammer horror was, in the 80s, that was, like, kind of creaky old, like, 60s horror, you know what I mean? And it was kind of cheesy, and it was going out of fashion a little bit.
I remember at the time, the way the movie felt in terms of tone was kind of like a cross between Salem's Lot and kind of like a teenage kind of adventure movie, is the way it felt at the time. But revisiting it again, there's a lot of adult themes in it.
Yeah.
The undertones and stuff. There's like three tiers to it. There's young guys, like 13, 14, 15-year-olds, and then guys in their late teens, 18, 19, and then there's an old guy story.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like showing three different groups of guys at different developmental stages.
Yeah.
Well, there's also the adults, too, so I guess you could say four.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like the married people.
Yeah.
And the vampire in a certain way. It kind of came off as kind of like it. But it just kind of showed guys at different levels of development.
Yeah.
The whole thing. Did you notice that theme?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the cool thing about it, like I said, you know, when Tom Holland wrote the screenplay, basically it was just like, you know, what if your next door neighbor was a vampire and you had to kill him and, like, you saw him killing people but no one would believe you? And he thought that would be, like, a really funny, you know, for a horror comedy, like a very funny topic. And like I said, he wanted to homage, you know, your kind of horror hosts, you know, like Sven Gulli and, you know, Zachary and Elvira and all that kind of stuff, because that was kind of going out of fashion. So with that, he wrote the character of, because at first he just had the kid. He had Charlie Brewster was like his main character, and he's like, I didn't know if I could make a whole movie out of that. But then he thought, well, here's this kid who's super obsessed with old horror movies, and he discovers that his next door neighbor is a vampire. Well, who would I go to if I was a teenager? And was I would go to the horror host, the guy that was in all the movies, the vampire killer. So then he's like, so then I decided to write that character into it. And from then, the movie just kind of wrote itself.
Yeah.
So he's even been quoted as saying that Charlie Brewster, you know, the kid in this, who's supposed to be 17 or 18 years old, he's still in high school. He's played by William Ragsdale in the movie, that he was like the engine that got the plot going. But that Peter Vincent, played by Roddy McDowall, who was fucking brilliant in this. That he was like the heart of the movie, which he really is, because he has like the biggest character arc, you know what I mean? Yeah. Because at the beginning, he's just, you know, he's on this like crappy TV horror host. He's on late at night. It's like he's showing all these old cheesy ass movies that he was in, like when he was much younger. He's actually much younger in... He was much younger in real life than he looks in this movie. They made him look much older.
Yeah, they got his hair grayed out.
They got his hair grayed and like makeup on and stuff.
In the HD versions of the movie, you could see it. But you couldn't see it in the VHS.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You couldn't see that it was fake white paint in the hair.
Yeah.
But it's pretty obvious in HD.
Yeah, because like I said, they wanted him to play like an old washed up like horror actor who wasn't even that good back in his day. He was just like in this cheesy Hammer knockoff shit.
Right.
And then he's just like at this fucking little local station, like showing all these old movies in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And the theme there, I'll tell you, it wasn't real obvious to me at the time. And it wasn't really spelled out in the movie. But you got this old British actor who's at the end of his career. And in the movies, he plays this like real brave Van Helsing style vampire killer. But in real life, he's kind of this old British queen and a coward, you know. And he didn't believe in any vampires. But there was a lot of character development in it, you know. After he realized that or was convinced that vampires did exist, he becomes the man that he pretended to be, you know, a real heroic figure. And it's not really spelled out that way. I guess it is. The movie wasn't promoted with that angle. You have to see it to see what it is you're talking about. Nowadays, they probably would have made that the central focus of the movie, but they didn't make a big deal out of it back then. Just dude became the man that he always wanted to be. He became self-actualized.
Even though, interestingly, when Tom Holland wrote the screenplay, I mean, he obviously wrote the character of Peter Vincent that was based on Peter Cushing and Vincent Price. And actually, he wanted Vincent Price for the role. But I've heard two stories. There's either, like, Vincent Price was like, I don't really want to do horror anymore. Or he was too sick to, you know, his health was too poor.
I could tell it was a Vincent Price.
But when Roddy McDowall got the role, he said that he modeled his performance after Bert Lahr, the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz. He's like, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted his like character arc to be like. That's what I wanted him to act like. Because he is like a super, super hammy, like over-the-top act. He's not even British. He's just like kind of like affecting that.
He was pretending to be British.
Yeah, okay. That's what I mean. So he was kind of like, because you could, I mean, he's obviously not, you know. So I mean, so that, you know.
I thought the actor was supposed to be British.
Well, he just like put on that affectation.
I gotcha.
Like I said, because you know how a lot of like those.
He was an actor.
He was one of those old school like actors.
Trying
to be
like a Shakespearean
actor. Except like I said, he knew he wasn't any good. And he's even said that in interviews that he's like, he's supposed to be like a washed up shitty actor from back in the old days who thought he was awesome.
Okay.
And then now he's like super,
I got you
know, now he's like at this shitty fucking TV station.
All right. That adds another dimension to it that I didn't know. I thought he was actually supposed to be a British character.
No.
He was a washed up American actor pretending to be British.
Yeah. He was just trying to be. Yeah. Okay. It was like that.
All right. That makes it even more.
That's what I mean. That's what was so fucking great about this movie. You guys, if you haven't seen this, seriously, this is easily one of the best, one if not the best horror comedies of the 80s. It's just, like I said, it's just such an affectionate homage to that genre. And so the whole premise of the story, like I said, you know, Charlie Brewster is this kid. He lives with his single mom. He's got a girlfriend who's played by Amanda Bierce, who obviously became famous later on for being the neighbor on Married with Children, Marcy Darcy. She was actually 27 in this, even though she was supposed to be a high school kid. But she still pulled it off, I thought. William Ragsdale was 24. I looked it up. Because we were saying all these movies with like all these kids playing high school students, and they were all in their 20s. They were. But so he's got this girlfriend, and her name is Amy. And this made us laugh, and this made Tom laugh. But they've been going out for a year, and Amy still has not put out.
Yeah, I don't know. I called bullshit on that immediately when I saw it. I said, no, I've been to high school at least once. Didn't go down that way.
Well, I don't think it would go down that way nowadays either.
It's yeah, like, a week was an eternity.
You could still get away with that, like, maybe in the 80s.
Hey, why are you holding out on me? Why are you holding out on me? It's been 2 weeks. Yeah.
Right, so it's like,
yeah.
In a way, like, I get where she was coming from, because she was like, she wasn't sure about it, and she was like kind of scared. She was a virgin and all this other kind of stuff. And he was actually pretty understanding about it, although he was, you know, understandably getting frustrated. So finally, they're at the house one night, like making out upstairs while mom is downstairs. And she's finally like, okay, we're going ahead with the sex. That's fine.
Yeah.
And then he gets distracted by two guys out in the yard carrying a coffin into the neighbor's house. Like someone's moving into the house next door. And he's like, there's two guys under the coffin. And he's like, and then she's like, so, and then he just like completely ignores her. She's sitting there with her bra and everything like that. She's like, all right, fuck you, buddy.
Yeah.
I'm taking off. So they're like having this fight through the whole thing. So, now, at first, like I said, because Charlie is just kind of, like, obsessed with horror movies, especially old horror movies, like Peter Vincent is his hero, and he loves, like, all these old, you know, these old movies. So, he just thinks it's kind of weird and stuff, so he kind of starts spying on the guy next door, especially after the next day when they get a fucking, when a call girl shows up at the house next door, and she's like, oh, is this, the- oh, okay, well, I'm gonna go over here, and he's like, all right.
Yeah.
So, all right. So Charlie's looking out the window that night because he saw the call girl go in there, and he's hoping to see some action. Pro tip to vampires out there, though, if you don't want to get caught for serial murder, close your shades, man, because like your neighbors are like watching you through the binoculars. So he's looking at the window through the binoculars, and he's got like his snacks and like, you know, some porn magazines on the ground and stuff like that. And he sees his neighbor, this suave motherfucker named Jerry Dandridge, who's played by Chris Sarandon. He actually sees little fangs come out, and he's got, like, big long nails and stuff, and it looks like he's going to bite this one in the neck. Then later on, he notices that someone is bringing a body, or what appears to be a body wrapped in black plastic, out and puts it into the back of a car. Now, he thinks it's weird, but he doesn't really, like, get super serious about it until the next day when he's at school, because then he sees, like, a news report that the call girl, there's a picture of her on the news, and it's, like, that she was found, I think she was found, like, beheaded or something like that. So he starts to freak out and say, okay, well, the neighbor's a vampire, he's obviously killing people. And so he tries to tell Amy and his best friend, who's played by Stephen Jeffries, Evil Ed, who's, like, another big horror nerd, and who is really great in this. He's, like, super funny. And so he tries to tell them, obviously they don't believe him, but he's like, look, I did see that girl over there. It's like, I'm not going to tell the cops he's a vampire. I'll just tell them that I saw that girl over there and they got to investigate. So the police come over to the house and there's like this whole thing that happens. Now, it happens too that Jerry Dandridge's character, who is the vampire, he also has a quote unquote roommate named Billy Cole, who I guess that's like his daytime protector. He's not human either, though.
No, he's like a thrall.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is, because I see a lot of people going, oh, well, he's not a vampire because he walks around in the daytime.
No, he's like a Renfield, like, you know, like Mr. Barlow's thrall.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Like, he can do human shit, but he's not
kind of. I think it's Anne Rice influence type stuff where, you know what I mean, dude wants to become a vampire, so he starts to become the servant of a vampire. He gets some blood, you know, he gets some powers. But in the end, that vampire is not going to turn him into a vampire. He's just using him.
Yeah.
Using him as a slave, basically.
Yeah.
That happens in a lot of vampire stories.
That's what I'm saying, because they need somebody to, like, watch over him during the daytime so people just don't bust in their house and, like, stake him and shit.
That started with Renfield.
Yeah.
He had some vampire blood in him, but he
was just because he didn't turn him into a full vampire. No. He was just kind of like his little...
They're disposable.
His little helper, yeah.
Yeah, they're disposable slaves, really.
Yeah. So it so happens that the cops come. They obviously, like, interview Billy Cole, and he's just like, oh, what? We just, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. And the cops... And then, like, Charlie, like, flips out and starts telling the cops, oh, you have to go down to the basement. They have coffins down there, and Jerry Dandridge's a vampire. So obviously the cops are like, yeah, fuck off, kid. And they don't believe him. So then he decides that he is going to go contact Peter Vincent, the great vampire killer, who is on TV and who is in all these old movies.
Yeah.
And obviously, and it so happens that the day he goes to the studio to, like, talk to Peter Vincent is the same day he's been fired from the show, his, like, you know, late night show, which is called Fright Night, because young people don't want to see vampire movies anymore, especially the kind that he used to do.
Yeah.
So
when this character shows up, I mean, I think the story gets interesting when this character shows up. Really, Roddy McDowall brings a lot to this movie,
and he loved this role.
Yeah,
I mean, he really
the role. Was into the it. Role I interpreted the role as that he's a gay character, and I remembered kind of like a bunch of gay undertones with the movie too, even between the vampire and his thrall.
There were a lot of people have pointed that out
because later on, you know, we don't want to tell the whole story, spoil the whole movie. Later on, the vampire betrays that thrall, really. That thrall rises to the occasion, willing to give his life for his vampire. It looked like to me like some, you know, trisexual shit going on, you know what I mean? They were bringing women in the triads, and they were just trying shit out, you know what I mean? You got a vampire, his wannabe vampire lover, and then these hookers that they're killing and drinking.
Yeah.
But it looked like love triangle shit to me.
It did, and kind of. The only really direct reference they make to that is where when Jerry Dandridge and what they called the live-in carpenter, when they first move in next door, Charlie's mom is, like, looking out the window, like, talking about how handsome Jerry Dandridge is.
Yeah.
And then she says, oh, but he's got a live-in carpenter over there. With my luck, he's probably gay.
Yeah.
Because she's single and on the make, man.
And then,
but he comes over and, like, she's all, you know, he's laying the charm on.
And Vincent is, he just comes off as a queen to me. An actor, you know, cowardly, but still a good guy. And the theme throughout the whole movie... It's not stated explicitly, but just as how I interpret it, throughout the movie, you got the teenage guy trying to save his teenage girlfriend, but in many ways, Vincent is trying to save the young guy from being killed by these vampires. And it all works out good, and he ends up being a hero. And that was the theme that I picked up from it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I may be wrong, but it's hard to... Roddy McDowall doing this part, he just comes across as a gay actor.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not married. He's an older guy. Nothing's ever brought up about his sexuality or having a wife or anything, but he's definitely defending people.
Yeah.
And he never makes a move on the kid. It's just that, you know what I mean? You could tell that he was very protective of everybody, really. And it just comes across as a gay character.
Yeah.
Just in the 80s,
but like I said, it could go either way. I think
in the 80s, they wouldn't spell it out. They'd leave it up to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's how I interpreted it.
I mean, most people that talk about, because a lot of people have talked about this movie having a gay subtext, which a lot of movies in the 80s did, actually.
So I'm not the only one who saw it.
Not so much with Vincent's character, but more with the vampire and, like I said, and his buddy. Like, well, that was kind of
We got a lot of gay subscribers. If you're gay, watch that movie and you get back with me. You tell me, is that guy gay? And I'm telling you that sounds like an 80s gay character, the way that character was written.
Maybe so, yeah.
Back in the 80s, they didn't push that to the forefront. They let you see it if you wanted to. And that's how I interpreted
it. Well, and like I said, I think that, one, you can tell because Roddy McDowall really, really wanted this part, and he really, really loved playing this character. And that really comes across.
Yeah.
He is, like you said, probably the most interesting character in the movie because he has the largest arc. He's very funny at the beginning. Like I said, he comes across very much like the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah.
Because he's an actor, he's the vampire killer in movies, so he's, like, very up himself. He's very full of himself. But when, like, dangerous shit really starts to happen, his first instinct is to, like, run and hide. He doesn't want anything to do with it. You know what I mean? Because at first, he doesn't believe Charlie that the guy's a vampire. You know, he tells the kid to fuck off. Finally, you know, Amy and Evil Ed, like, come to him, and he's just like, no, that kid's crazy. It's like, there's no such thing as vampires. And they're like, look, you really have to help him out. He's going to kill the guy next door, you know, while he's sleeping if you don't do something. And finally, they offer to pay him. They're going to give him, like, $500 if he will come and perform a quote-unquote vampire test on Jerry Dandridge in front of Charlie so that Charlie will, you know, will be convinced that he is not a vampire.
Yeah, and then the way the story ends, you got a guy who is a fake, basically, an actor.
Yeah.
Okay, a fake vampire killer who's cowardly. He's queenly, kind of effeminate, you know what I mean? He's gay. He's not a success, and he's losing his job. He's not a success. That character moves into a gay hero, really. That's how I interpreted it.
Yeah.
He was still gay, but no, he really was a vampire killer. He killed a bunch of them in the movie. How many vampires did he actually kill, including the thrall? Maybe four?
Well, no, because, well, he killed...
I think you could probably count
two,
three. Two, three, four.
Yeah, two, and then, well, because they, kind of him and Charlie both kind of got together and killed. Because they're the only...
Weren't some people that turned into vampires?
No, just Evil Ed.
Just Evil Ed, okay.
And he killed, that was, oh my God, we have to talk too about...
So he killed two vampires and a thrall.
Yeah.
So he killed multiple
Although men. Charlie killed the thrall, I think. Because he shot him a bunch of times and it didn't do anything. Okay. Like he got
but he
back
was
up.
In on it. That and was then, the
yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was the first one that they killed, and that's really where Vincent started to get confidence that you can fight vampire type things.
Yeah.
So that was the first part of his
because at first
transition.
they thought Billy Cole was just a guy.
Right.
So he brought a gun and he's like, well, we can just shoot him. He's just a dude. But then he got back.
Well,
up.
By the end of by the end of Vincent's story arc. He's a successful hero, and he gets his show back.
Yeah.
So he actually becomes the man he wanted to be.
Yeah.
Which I thought that was awesome.
The one he always played in the movie.
The ones that he always played in the movie, that's what he really became.
Yeah.
And the lesson was, my interpretation, having come up in the 80s, the subtext in the writing, is that a gay man could be a hero. That's how I interpreted it.
Yeah. But yeah, like I said, it could be interpreted that way. You could also interpret it like in a more kind of universal way where it's just like, you know, like I said, he was just like a cowardly character and he just like...
I was looking at it from the 80s Hollywood perspective. Yeah. There were a lot of gay people in Hollywood at that time, and that was the story that I believe that they were showing.
Yeah.
That, you know what I mean?
I have to say, too, that the special effects in this are amazing. Particularly the special effect where Evil Ed, after he gets turned into a vampire and he like attacks Peter Vincent in a wolf form, and then Peter Vincent ends up like staking him with like a sharp like a table leg, and he kind of like turns back into Evil Ed as he's dying, and it's like not only a really awesome like special effect scene, but it's also like a really affecting scene because Peter Vincent, you can tell that he feels really really bad that he had to kill this little kid, you know, he's not a little kid, but he's like a teenager. You know, because he turned into a vampire. And, you know, just like cool, like the wolf transformation, like as he's going back into the, you know, person and stuff like that is really cool. Also, I want to say, too, that when Amy gets vampified, she is almost unrecognizable, like when they did. Because, you know, they tried to make her look very good girl. She had like the shorter hair. And it's like a little bit boyish kind of. And
she wasn't very attractive, actually.
Yeah.
She was attractive as a vampire, but not.
That's
not
what
as
I mean.
A,
it was like a huge upgrade.
Yeah.
So like when she got vampified by Jerry, because she got kidnapped by him for a while and, you know, he bit her and stuff. And she comes out in like this Marilyn Monroe looking dress. She's got this long, like red, wild hair. And she had this.
Better makeup.
Yeah. And it's like, well, the best scene, and this scene used to like kind of freak me out when I was younger, is when, you know, when she's. Kind of turns her face away from Charlie, and she's like, "You said he wasn't gonna, you wouldn't let him get me." And then she turns around, and she has that huge fucking mouth with like all this fucking teeth in
it—like a
shit
frog
like that.
Mouth with a bunch of teeth in it.
Yeah, it almost like, it looked like a big like snake face or something like that. It was just like really, really cool.
Yeah.
I have to say too that a lot of the effects work. There's a really good. It was on Shudder. It's not on there anymore. But there was a 3.5 hour documentary about the making of Fright Night, and it was called You're So Cool, Brewster, which if you've seen the movie, you'll know why it's called that. And they went into, like, exhaustive detail about, like, the making of it and all the special effects and everything like that. And it's just, you know, they were talking about the fucking contact lenses, which, you know, now contact lenses, they're just, like, that thin plastic and it's, like, super easy and stuff. But back then, they were made of, like, they were really thick glass and they had to, like, buff them and, like, get all the shit out of there. And they had some problems with, you can only wear them for 20 minutes at a time. And then they had to take them out because you couldn't see through them. You know, like, those big, like, yellow fucking things that they wore. But yeah, so special effects amazing. I love the Evil Ed character. I've seen this movie probably a million times. I used to have it on VHS back in the late 80s. And it's just super fun. It's, you know, there's like some 80s cheese, like with the nightclub scene and stuff like that. But it actually has some great songs in it too. Like they had one by Sparks. The Jay Giles Band did the theme song, like the title song and stuff like that. Now, here's something that was really interesting. I had completely forgotten that they made a Fright Night Part 2. It came out in 1988.
Oh, yeah, I didn't remember that.
And I was thinking to myself, it's like, okay, I know I must have seen this at some point. But, so I found it on YouTube, like, kind of a shitty, like, old VHS copy, like, pan and scan.
Any good?
It's actually not bad.
Oh, we should watch it, then.
The only recurring cast, they got William Ragsdale back as Charlie, and they got Roddy McDowall back as Peter Vincent.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But, it's actually, like, because I'm watching it, and I was like, I probably saw this because every now and then, like, I'd see a scene or, like, a line read or something. I'm like, that seems familiar. So I must have seen this, but I didn't remember anything about it. So I must have seen it, like, one time.
Was the writing as good?
It was a different writer and a different director. Tom Holland was, like, on set and, like, he did, like, consult on the script and stuff like that. It's not... I mean, it's a similar, pretty similar storyline. Yeah. It's like what you get is, you know, Charlie's in college now. He has a different girlfriend because Amanda Burst didn't want to come back for the second one. So it's like, you know, he's in college, he's in a dorm. And then basically there's a vampire named Regine, and she is, you know, they reveal later on that she is the sister of Jerry Dandridge, and she's kind of come looking for them because revenge. And she kind of has, like, a whole little vampire posse. Mm-hmm. Now, an interesting angle that they did for the sequel, too, was that at the beginning, Charlie has been in therapy, and he has convinced himself that vampires aren't real.
Oh, so they got to go through that.
And that, yeah, and that the whole thing, like, with Jerry Dandridge and everything, he's like, oh, well, Jerry Dandridge was just a regular old serial killer, and I imagine that he was a vampire and stuff. But Peter Vincent still believes, so there's kind of, like, a conflict there where... You know,
trying to get him to remember,
where Charlie like goes back to see him, and he's just, you know.
Well, the first version, the writing is top notch.
It is, yeah.
You got the very superficial story that happens, and then there's all these subtexts that are there, or maybe they're not there, but that's a sign of good writing to me. They let you decide what it is that you see outside that normal story arc, which you know what I mean, like all the subtexts we're talking about. Yeah, to me, that's always a sign of good writing. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely.
To where you see the story, you watch the story, you enjoy it, but then you go, wait a minute, was this going on? Was this actually happening? Yeah. But the different levels of it.
Yeah, you can read different things into it. That's always, like, really good. Like really
the scene, like the death scene between Evil Ed and Vincent is there, and the way Vincent's interaction with this, you know, dying vampire, what are we seeing there? You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of emotion going on.
Yeah.
You know? Are we just seeing normal compassion, or are we seeing a gay subtext? We don't know.
Yeah.
But that's what made the movie cool. It's on you to interpret it.
Yeah. And like I said, I think it's important to note, too, that, like, you know, Tom Holland, he started as an actor, and then he went into screenwriting, and he, like, is actually, like, has written, like, a lot of really good movies, particularly in the horror genre. So he knew what he was doing with this shit. Like, he's come at it from an actor's point of view. He comes at it from a writer's point of view. Like I said, this was the first movie that he directed. And that's kind of amazing because this movie
is
it's a cult classic.
Yeah, not only are they telling you the stories, not only are all these subtexts, there's also morality tales happening between all this stuff. And I like that kind of shit. I like things that are very close to, you know, mythology.
Yeah.
You know, Star Wars level type. Early, you know, we're talking about, you know, the original Star Wars movie level,
yeah,
you know, mythologies, you know, which is good stories with, you know, symbolism and stuff and morality tales. I'm into that. Yeah. And this is a movie that is like that.
Well, and plus this movie is just fun. And
yeah,
like
a
I
lot
said,
of fun,
it's,
yeah.
It's just a fun movie. Yeah. It's got like funny moments. It's got scary moments. There's good special effects and stuff.
Yeah. You can drink during this movie.
Yeah, it's just super fun.
Yeah, if you can pay attention to it and see all these themes and all these lessons, but you don't have to take it that seriously.
Yeah.
But the tone of the movie is kind of playful.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like that.
But even though, like I said, it's still got creepy kind of shit going on, but... You know, the character of Jerry Dandridge is very, very good. Chris Sarandon plays a great fucking vampire, even though he was initially reluctant because he's like, oh, I don't really want to do another horror movie, even though he went on to do Child's Play with Tom Holland as well. Yeah. But you know what I mean? So it's just all the characters are good. They all work together really good.
Yeah.
Another thing, too, that I wanted to mention, and maybe the reason why this works so well and why all the characters interacted so well with one another, was that Tom Holland had the whole movie pretty much storyboarded out, like scene for scene. And he gave all the actors 2 weeks, and they worked the whole movie through like a stage play, like over and over and
again. Yeah, you can. Okay, I can feel it in the movie. Yeah. I can see that in the movie.
They did it like
That's
a play.
That's why the movie has such a good flow to it.
Yeah, and because these characters had been interacting with each other. They all had their own backstories that they made up about the characters.
A lot happens in this movie. I forgot how much actually happens in the movie.
It is, it's really, really well-paced. Yeah.
It moves along quickly, and a lot of shit happens for the story to unfold. And there's a lot there without it being messy or tedious. It's a good movie. It's a lot better than I remembered it. It just goes to show you how good the storytelling was of the 80s. It wasn't all good.
Yeah.
There was some
shit. Yeah, there was a lot of shit in the 80s.
But the dudes that knew their shit back in the 80s could tell you a badass story.
Yeah.
And no matter who you were, what your politics were, you could enjoy that story. And understand that message, and under, you know, they were just real good at it.
Oh yeah, and like I said, one of the best things, and one of the things that keeps me coming back to this movie is that you can tell that Tom Holland, who wrote it, he was really, really, he really loved old school horror. He loved all those cheesy Hammer movies. He loved like all this old horror hosts and stuff. So he's like having fun with that, but he's not making fun of it. There's like, you know what I mean? It's very affectionate.
Kind of using a
homage.
Kind of using a similar template or a tonal template. Well, not you just have to see it. You have to see it. Draw your own conclusions. I think it's a high quality movie. I'd like to see the sequel now. Now I didn't know that there was one.
It's I watched it a couple hours ago, like before we recorded this. It's actually not bad. I had seen it back in the 80s because I did remember a couple of scenes, but it hadn't made an impression the same way.
We'll wait a few weeks. You've already seen it.
Well, I was only paying attention to like the first half because I was doing some other shit. So we can watch.
I
want to
see it in high quality. If I'm going to see it, I'll rent it.
Yeah, you should probably rent it.
But I'll tell you what, Fright Night will be in my Blu-ray collection. I will eventually buy this one.
Yeah, because like I said, I had this on VHS. I've probably seen it at least 50 times, if not more.
We also, right after this, we watched Lost Boys. That one I also want to own. I forgot how good that movie
That'll
was.
That'll probably be the next review, I'm imagining.
Because, sneak peek. Probably Lost Boys.
Oh, and I have to mention, too, I haven't seen it, but in 2011, there was a remake of Fright Night. I kind of want to see it, even though I read the Wikipedia plot synopsis. It's similar, but they did a couple different things with it. David Tennant actually plays the Peter Vincent character.
Okay.
And he is not an old school horror host because they thought that modern audiences wouldn't connect as much with that. Because,
Little do they know.
Yeah, I know, but it's like, so they thought
horror
that wouldn't work.
Boy, those don't exist. Yeah.
They thought that wouldn't work. So they made him like a Chris Angel type, like Vegas, like a washed up Vegas magician,
okay.
Who also happened to be a vampire expert for whatever reason. Colin Farrell plays the Jerry Dandridge character. It has like a lot of good actors in it. Anton Yelchin, who passed away, you know, he was in the Star Trek movies and stuff like that. That younger kid, he played the Charlie Brewster character.
We'll see it.
But I've heard that I think the people that were in the original movie, like they got asked about it at like a horror convention, and some of them said, yeah, it was all right, but it wasn't really in the same spirit. And particularly Stephen Jeffries, who played Evil Ed in the original one, he thought, well, I didn't really like the Evil Ed character in the new one because he seemed a little mean-spirited, whereas in the original movie, he was just kind of a goofball.
Yeah.
And I think in the remake, too, they made it, like, Charlie and Evil Ed weren't friends anymore because Charlie had, like, started hanging out with, like, a cooler crowd, and, like, Evil Ed was, like, super dorky and he didn't want to hang out with them anymore. So they had that kind of thing going on, which wasn't in the original. I mean, in the original, Charlie wasn't really a dork. He was just kind of like a regular dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, Evil Ed was kind of dorky, but lovably dorky. You know what I'm saying?
I thought he was annoying.
He's a little bit annoying, yeah. Annoying.
But, you know, he was better as a vampire.
True.
Yeah, he was a scary... Well, he was a freaky vampire.
Yeah, with that hair sticking up and everything like that. And it's funny because he actually wanted, when he went to read for the part, he actually wanted the Charlie Brewster role. But then they called it back and said, no, we want you to be Evil Ed. And he was kind of bummed out about that. and he didn't want to do the sequel, even though he died in the first one. But, you know, they thought they could bring him back somehow. But what?
Oh, I just forgot to mention that the practical effects in this are really strong.
Yeah. I said that before.
Did you? Okay. Yeah. They're very good. There was just something about CG that could ruin this movie. The tone of the movie and the time, the setting and everything, just when the movie was made.
I heard the CG in the remake was not good.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't have CG at this time because they would have used it and it would have fucking ruined it.
And it would have been terrible.
Yeah, because the way they worked with the practical effects, it kept the movie tonally, was consistent throughout the whole thing. And it's a masterpiece of what... this movie's a masterpiece of what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's not... You're not talking about The Shining or anything like that. It's just... It's a Saturday night movie.
Yeah, it's a fun horror comedy.
Right, and it's doing its job really well, and it stood up the test. It stood the test of time. If you ask me, in my humble opinion, 50 years of fucking excellence, I'm telling you, in my opinion, the movie holds up.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant movie. And like I said, it's not only like kind of scary, it's funny.
Yeah.
And it also has like a really, really good heart to it, which a lot of horror movies don't have.
It was that time... when Spielberg was still doing good shit. He still does good stuff, but there, there's something about 80s Spielberg. There's something about that 80s middle-class America setting where you have this fucking tone, you know, like Back to the Future. It's just like, it's like that.
Yeah, it's in like that same kind of vein.
It's in that same tonal place to where...
It's kind of like a horror movie version of Back to the Future, exactly. I guess.
Exactly. Sort of. You can go back and watch that movie, and it takes you into that time. And evidently, young people, the younger generation still like it. You know, they like a lot of this 80s stuff, even the new retro wave and stuff that's coming out. And all the, to them, it's retro, but they get it. The quality is there. You can watch these old movies and go, yeah, that was a badass story.
Yeah. And this is definitely
one that
stands out and like stands the test of time, like I said.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the remake yet. If you've seen it, tell me. I've heard it wasn't terrible. Like, it got like pretty decent reviews.
Yeah.
And they also made a sequel to that,
which
came out in 2013, but I think it went direct to video, so I haven't seen that either.
Our AMC theaters doing reruns of 80s and 70s classics like Alien 1.
Yeah, we
and
saw
Shining
Alien on the big screen,
And they're putting up Ghostbusters, and they do it only... Those nights are packed.
Yeah.
And they're packed with, you know, Gen Z.
Yeah.
You know? So it's making a comeback. The younger audience understands this tone.
It almost seems like the 80s never went away.
Like it's,
you know what I mean?
It never really went away. The good things of the 80s kind of have survived.
I mean, there was a lot of shitty stuff in the 80s too. Like,
but it's gone.
But no one remembers it.
It's gone.
That's just kind of like what happens from every decade.
Right.
It's like there's always a bunch of shit that like nobody remembers.
Yeah.
But the good shit from the 80s like is still
can live
around.
On. You know, like you just can't beat Indiana Jones 1.
Yeah.
That movie will just always exist. It will always that movie will stand the test of time.
Yeah.
You know.
And same with Fright Night. I mean, this is easily
and you know
one of my favorite horror
movies.
The
Back to the Futures. Some of the Eddie Murphy movies, you know, Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
1 and 2 will always, to me, will always be great cop comedies.
Yeah.
You know, 80s.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say, too, that, like, speaking of Fright Night, I really, really, one of these days, I was going to do it this year, but I didn't think of it in time. I wanted to do the Vampire Amy Halloween costume, if I can find a dress like that. But I need to do, like, a whole, like, cast
that,
in my
face.
Like, I looked it up, and because I was curious to see if anybody had done it. And I did find two girls that had done it. One girl did it just with makeup, and that looked pretty cool. And one girl, like, went whole hog, and she, like, you know, made a latex cast of her whole face and, you know, did that. And that looked pretty cool, too. But it doesn't seem to be a very common Halloween costume. Yeah. I mean, as well known as Fright Night is,
and or at least was.
Yeah, and particularly if you Google Fright Night, I mean, that's one of the first pictures that comes up is Amy with that big fucking mouth with all the teeth sticking out of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that dress, like with the, like I said, it's kind of like a halter dress that looks sort of Marilyn Monroe-ish. So, I don't know, maybe I'll do that one of these days. Got to get some yellow and red contact lenses and big old latex bang mouth. Easy to do now. Yeah, I could probably do that pretty cheaply, honestly. But yeah, if you have not seen Fright Night from 1985, what the hell is the matter with you? You really, really need to see it because it's one of the best movies of the 80s, you know, by any measure. So you should definitely check it out. And then, you know, the sequel's not bad either. And I've heard the remake's okay, but I haven't seen it yet, so I can't comment. All right, so we will see you next time. Bye.